everyone, and welcome to Ammo Art Chat. We're live tonight with Joanna Arnett, and we'll be talking about plein air versus still life painting, which one's better. I just wanted to mention we got some new and what I feel is wonderful opening music and closing music, and that was composed by Wayne Johnson, who's a friend of mine, and actually will be joining us on the June 21st show, where we're going to talk about the creative process and how similar it is between musicians and artists. So make sure you mark down that date. It'll be June 22nd, and it'll be 7 p.m. Eastern. I want to welcome all of our listeners in today. We actually had some great response to our past show, and want to thank everyone for passing on the link and talking about the show. I think that's been a big help, and we're always happy to know that people are listening and are supporting us. It's a really great feeling. So thank you all very much for tuning in and taking time out of your busy schedule. I want to mention that we have the chat room open, and we have a couple folks in the chat room already. Hello to you all. And also wanted to give out the number that you can call in. That's 760-542-3932. I'm Linda Fissler. I'm one of the hosts of this evening. I also want to bring in my co-hosts of the evening, which we have two with us. The first one you actually met on the last show, and that's Blanche McAllister Harris. Hello, Blanche.
Hi, Linda. Welcome, everyone. I'm excited to be back tonight.
Yeah, well, we're excited to have you back. Thanks for hanging in there with me. So, and I also wanted to bring in Barbara as well. Barbara Coleman is new. This is her first show, so welcome, Barbara.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your art journey and how you got involved with us?
Yes. I started painting in college and was fortunate enough to go to France to study painting and have a very wonderful experience there, traveling around and looking in all the museums and doing a lot of plein air work. And came back to New Mexico, where I am living now. And, you have to make a living, and I wasn't sure I could with my painting. And I got a master's in community and regional planning and worked as a city planner and urban designer for a number of years. And that was really fun because I was drawing all the time and thinking of spaces, in a very large-scale way in terms of how streetscapes worked and how people moved through them. And then I was a professor at the University of New Mexico for about 11 years, where I taught drawing and design in the architecture program. And all along, I kept painting. I was painting in pastel, so I'm a signature member of the Pastel Society of America, and was raising three kids. And one day, the urge to start painting in oils was just so overwhelming that I switched to oils, began painting in oils, and completely fell in love with that medium. So at this point in time, I show at Alexandra Stevens Gallery in Canyon Road in Santa Fe, and have been working kind of in my own way and really felt the need to change, shake things up, really challenge myself, get out of my comfort zone, and I signed up with a workshop with Kevin McPherson. And that turned out to be one of the best decisions I ever made and started me into working with him, studying with him in the summers, and then into the Protégé program, which, to give a plug for that program, I have to say is just an incredible way to be mentored in your painting and have a truly expert, critical but kind eye look at your work. And so it did just what I wanted, was able to shake me up, make me grow, challenge me, and keep going with that. So that's where I am now, is painting. Left the university to paint full-time, run a business with my husband, and I'm in the studio practically every day.
Well, that's great. And, welcome aboard. We're glad to have you as much, and I'm also very glad to have Blanche. And Blanche, I don't know, was there something else you wanted to add before we bring Joanna in?
Oh, no, I'm anxious to hear Joanna's thoughts. I've been doing a little plein air painting over the last couple of weeks, taking advantage of all the beautiful spring weather. I've even been thinking about setting up a still life outside and painting that, so I can't wait to hear Joanna's thoughts on all of this.
And she'll be able to give you pointers on setting that still life up outside, too. So we want to do that right now. We actually want to bring Joanna now, but I want to talk a little bit about Joanna's life as an artist. She earned a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree from the University of Texas, and then she worked in advertising at Young and Rubicam in New York, where she was a senior art director, working on accounts with Merrill Lynch and the U.S. Postal Service. She continued her art studies, her fine art studies, at the Art Students League, in New York. Joanna is a master artist, and she was on Passport and Palette. She also wrote for that program and helped produce that program, and that has been shown throughout the United States on a number of PBS stations. She became a master artist and the Artist of American Show in Denver Historical Society Museum, and she also exhibits at museums around the country, and is currently, I believe, Joanna, you can correct me on this when I give her a chance to talk, she's currently in the show, in a Rendezvous show at the Gilchrist Museum, so she'll tell us a little bit about that. And she's written a number of articles. She enjoys writing. She's authored a book as well, which I'm sure a number of our listeners are familiar with, and it's the painting Sumptuous Vegetables, Fruits, and Flowers in Oil. She's been associated with the Zaplin Lampard Gallery in Santa Fe for 24 years, so she's been showing her work there, and she'll have a major show coming up in early 2013, which I also want Joanne to tell us a little bit about as we get into the show. The show will include still life, landscape, and painting of figures and markets from her recent plein air trips to Ecuador. And most recent news for Joanna is she started a business with her husband, James Asher, called Artful Partners, and they just released a wonderful DVD, 4 hours. It's got demo painting, and she also included critiques from her students who were gracious enough to be recorded for their critiques. And it's a very wonderful learning DVD. So, Joanna, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Linda. It's a pleasure to be here and welcome everybody. And Blanche and Barbara, I'm excited to talk to you guys. And I know you've got a great and somewhat controversial topic and some wonderful questions. So I'm looking forward to that.
Okay, Blanche, I believe that we're going to start off with you to get this ball rolling. So why don't you go ahead and give Joanna her first question.
Okay, let's see, Joanna. Well, we'll start with plein air painting. Can you tell us what you think the benefits are of plein air painting?
How long do we have? It's probably one of my favorite topics, and I think it would be a better art world out there with higher quality work if everybody in every genre took a turn at plein air. I don't care if you prefer the studio and you want to be a studio painter, that's great, but plein air has so many benefits. And I paint probably 60% outdoors and 40% indoors, except when certain flowers are blooming, and then I'm doing still life. Which I am today. So today's lilac day. Lilacs in Santa Fe are blooming, and they're amazing. Outdoors, I think the training outdoors is amazing. Whether you wind up being a plein air artist or not, if you'll go outdoors, you'll find that your skills are honed. They're really focused. You have your skills at observation. You have to look, and you have to look hard, and you have to look fast, because the light waits for no one. You know, unless it's an overcast day when you have, of course, more time. But on a bright light day, the light is moving. And so your visual memory, looking at something, remembering what it looks like, that has to increase. You have no choice, because literally every time you look at your painting and look back up at the scene that you're painting, something changed. So enhancing your visual memory is one thing. I think it's really, really important. It may sound very simplistic, guys, to say this, but it's hard to get people to look. You know, we all see, we all think we see, but most of the time when I'm painting or when I'm teaching outdoors or indoors, I'm saying, look, don't you see this? And they will have been looking at something for 4 hours and go, oh, no, I didn't see that. And I think that painting outside in plein air is one of the things that will really, really help your observation skills. It's just good for everybody. It makes you look. And the other thing, I think if you're in a situation, maybe your brush has gotten a little tight. Maybe you want it to relax a little bit. Plein air will do that for you because it has no mercy. The sun moves. So stopping and laboring something, you know, working it over, you just don't have the chance. And I think that's a very, very good thing. And if you'll hang on to the enhanced visual memory, if you'll hang on to the freshness of the brush that you'll gain from working outside due to the limited time, and you'll bring those skills inside, I think you'll see a real difference in the work that you do inside. I mean, those are just off the top. I think you have a greater chance of really understanding aerial perspective. I love linear perspective, and Barbara, I was excited to hear that you had taught drawing in an architectural setting, and so I think that's a wonderful thing. But I love linear, but aerial perspective is something that I think working outside, you really, really, really must come to an understanding about. And you can translate that indoors, whereas outside you're trying to push a mountain back. Indoors, you may be trying to push one flower behind another flower, and the same rules, the same principles apply. They're just more obvious and more overt outside. But if you'll remember what you learned outside about cooling your colors and decreasing contrast, those sorts of things, the same things work indoors. So, guys, just right off the top of my head, some quick answers. That's a start.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's plein air painting is amazing. What you can see, what you were talking about seeing like an artist when you're looking at things, actually seeing is very important. I think we've all been there with that.
Yeah, that's kind of a universal thing, and it's one of the reasons that when I'm outdoors, I actually teach a little bit. You know, Kevin McPherson, obviously you guys know, is a very dear, heartfelt friend. He and Wanda have been a great part of my life and a very positive and beautiful part. Really, we started working together. He invited me graciously to teach for In Plein Air Masters in France several years ago, and that was a great experience. And then we went on to be co-hosts of Passport and Palette. But, you know, Kevin and I teach a little bit differently in that I ask, I beg, I plead for my artists to do drawings of their, not on the canvas, I don't want that, but I ask them to bring a sketchbook and I'll ask them to do drawings, not tight drawings, but drawings with general information and values before they begin. And I did it for two reasons. Number one, it cements your composition before you start. But really, even bigger than that, it makes you look. You have to look at something. If you're going to draw it, you have to look at it. And I'm not talking about a long drawing. It's 20 minutes, maybe 15 minutes before you start your painting. So doing that, even if you don't like the drawing, it's not really important. The important thing is it makes you look. It makes you stop and consider and think. And it's far more exciting and lovely to do that in a 15-minute drawing than to get an hour down the road with your painting going, oh, geez, why didn't I see that before? So I'm pretty adamant about that. Love to see you guys draw more.
Oh yeah, that's always helpful. And I'm working on your composition before you get too far into it. The drawing helps with that.
It really does. It's easy to if you put something down on paper with a soft pencil and you realize that you put something important right in the middle of your painting, or you split the painting, you split the horizon, or you split it laterally or vertically, then it's very easy to simply recrop the drawing, and then you've told yourself, don't do that in the painting.
Right. Yeah. Those are great tips. Thank you so much. Barbara?
Well, Joanna, I think, too, that when you're drawing it and you're really paying attention and seeing, that it has the opportunity to make you so present and observant of what there is and what you really are moved by before you're actually committed to a painting, which is harder to shift around than just doing another composition and kind of opening yourself to the scene ahead of you. I appreciated when you were speaking about aerial perspective, because when I was teaching at the university and I would have these young students come in and expect to learn how to draft, and what this studio was about was learning how to see. And so we would do the studio as a regular kind of art studio, even with live models, portraiture, et cetera, so that the students would really learn how to see. And then typically in an architecture studio, often you'll have a plan view that you ask kids to turn into a perspective. Well, I would often say, okay, here's the perspective. Do you have a good enough, strong enough sense of space to turn that back into a plan? And the whole goal was basically to bring these kids more alive so they could really see and go beyond just anything, just drafting. And so that was really fun. And with the benefit you've talked about with plein air, you know, loosening up your brush, how it has no mercy, it enhances your visual memory. What do you think the benefits of still life painting are?
Well, that's another tome as well. For one thing, I think, well, there's the list just goes on and on. With still life, I think that you have to think a great deal. You have to. I love the fact that there is absolutely nothing there. Nothing exists until you create an environment. You decide what you want to paint, how you want to paint it, in what context. You decide what you want to say about it. Where with plein air, you know, I love that you use the word present. We go to a scene, we look around, we become very present in the scene. You put yourself in it, but it already exists, and you find from what is already there, what already exists, what is going to touch you in studio or any still life or any studio piece. Literally, there's nothing there. There's nothing until you decide what you're going to paint today. And after all, guys, I mean, we can talk about the benefits of indoor, outdoor, but question number one for all artists is today, what are you going to paint? And it doesn't matter where you paint it. What are you going to paint? Are you going to go outside and paint the tree in front of you, or the mountains, or the three mountains? Am I going to go outside and paint lilacs, or am I going to bring the lilacs indoors? I'm going to paint a whole street of lilacs or just five blossoms. What are you going to paint is huge. It's number one. So indoors, starting from scratch, you really have to be creative. You really have to be open to experimenting, deciding those things that are important to you, the things that touch you. You have no jumping off place. It's just you and a blank canvas. I think it helps you to create worlds that are your very own. You may decide to create a world about a certain subject. You may decide to create a brand new world about a certain world of color or color relationships. You may decide to create a world from the very beginning about the way one certain piece of movement works. So it's a very, very original thing, starting from nothing. Now, I probably love outdoor more than anything, but, you know, at least with outdoors, you go to some place because you're interested in that place, and you go to some place because there's something about that environment that interests you. And I think that's wonderful to respond to that. Creating something, creating an original composition from a world that's in front of you. You guys, you know, I know you paint outside a lot, and among the interesting things I think that I get from my students, they go outside and they say, well, I'm so overwhelmed. There's so much to see. Everything around me is beautiful. I don't know what to do. And you begin that narrowing down process until you focus your energy, your attention, your passion on what it is about that scene that touched you in the first place. And you do that inside as well. You begin with elements that you think are interesting, that touch you, and you refine and you refine and you refine. So basically you're doing the same thing outdoors as you are indoors, except that indoors you're starting further back in the creative process. So let me do a tiny little soapbox here about still life. I think that we don't, again, use our minds enough. I think we don't do enough thinking indoors about still life. I think we're too happy to go put some pretty flowers and a pear on a table and start. And I preach a lot about that. That's not good enough. That is just, you know, it has to be as original as any other kind of painting. You know, start with being passionate about what you're painting, and don't be satisfied until a composition is there that really speaks to you. I mean, when you're outdoors and you're looking at a mountainscape, you're looking at a river, you don't just put your easel up and begin to paint a river. You decide what's important there. You decide what piece of information there is the most important thing to you. So I want us to, in our still life painting, which is terrifically beneficial, I want us to really understand that it's to not be satisfied. I think that there's a lot of bad still life out there. I really do. And I think that part of that is because we're satisfied too soon with just putting something on a table and painting it. And it may be a good execution, but it may be passionless.
I've always struggled with composition in still life.
I'm sorry, would you repeat the question?
Oh, I've just said I've always struggled with composition in still life as opposed to painting a scene outdoors or from a reference photo. I have a harder time with the composition in a still life.
That's a comment that I hear an awful lot. And I think it is because of what I was saying earlier, that outdoors, at least, I mean, you may not paint what's right in front of you. You may move a mountain. You may move a building, a tree line. You know, you may put things in, take things out. But at least you have something to start with. And it's still like you're starting from nothing. And so I urge you to, you know, don't walk away from the composition principles that you learn outside. It's really not a lot different. You have to keep the eye moving around the canvas. You have to find some places of rest, some places of interest. There are a lot of different compositional things that we do indoors as well as outdoors. But I think the fact is, you know, when you're outdoors and you have, at least have some starting place. So with your indoor compositions, just take some time, find some things, some objects, or a color world, or something that just touches you. If you see something that is, you know, a singular thing, and begin to build a composition around that. What about this do I find interesting? What I find fascinating about? Start simple with a certain thing. What do you find fascinating about onions? You know, is it the one shape? Is it all the shapes? Is it all the colors? I mean, that's a great place to start. Move them around. Don't be satisfied. Do some drawings. Do some value studies. It's really the same thing. The problem is, we give up too soon until we're really, really excited and happy with how the eye moves through a composition. And it's just the same kind of work you would do for a piece outside. You know, even you are not putting that tree, that mountain, in exactly the same place that it may be growing. You may not. You're moving it. You're making. I mean, the only important thing is at the end of the day, you have a painting that works. You have a painting that touches you, and touch. Hopefully, if it touches you, it will touch somebody else. But really, it's only important that it touches you. And so I know that you guys. I do too. You don't just put something where it lands. You move it. You change it. So have that same attitude indoors. Except you're physically. I mean, outdoors you're having to move a tree in your head, and indoors you're moving the onion until it's in the right place. What I see, my experience for teaching for 20 years, is that we give up on our indoor compositions too soon, and we're satisfied too soon. Sometimes I'll work on a composition for you know, I may have an idea for a composition. I may do a sketch, and I may do the painting next year. I'm working on, about to start a very large and complicated painting, and the first thing I did was a color study, and I'll probably do a few more until I'm satisfied with how this composition is going to work out. I don't do that all the time, but I do it especially with large compositions and things that are complex color worlds or complex forms. So keep your scraps of canvas or your old scrubbed off paintings. I've got stacks of those, we all do. And don't be afraid to just take a great big brush and do a color study. Do a study before you begin.
Mm-hmm. Joanna, do you think when you're doing the still life that it's important to just start to see things not as objects, not as, you know, oh, this is a pear, this is an apple, this is a whatever, but to just start to see them as color shapes and negative shapes in between them? Does that kind of balance enter into your thinking as you're setting up a still life?
Absolutely. It's, you know, we do that outdoors. You want to do a value study. You want the values to be very interesting outdoors, and so you want to do something that's got, you know, a few limited strong values, and you want to do the same thing inside. So when I do a study for a complex painting, I'll do a 6x8 canvas with a number 12 brush, and it has nothing to do with an orange. It's just a piece of information there with another piece of information. With my studies, it's rare that you can even tell what they are. I know what they are, and I know how the forms are relating. I know how the eye's flowing, and I know the travel around the canvas. But it really, all painting, I don't care what it is. I don't care if you're indoors or outdoors or looking out a window. All painting is just about shapes. That's all it is. Getting the correct relationship of shapes, the correct relationships of value. So, you know, we all think that, oh, I can't do that because I don't do figures or I don't do landscape or I don't do still life. We need to throw that away. We need to throw that kind of thinking away, because what you do are shapes and shape relationships, and that's what good art is.
I had a comment by one of our online chat folks said that they actually draw thumbnails right away, making notations and directions of light that drew them to the scene. That was from Artistic Mind, who posted that. So thank you for your comment. But what that actually leads me to something else, Joanna, and you talked about it at the workshop last week, and that's abstraction. And it's something that's actually common to both plein air and still life and basically any genre, if you will. You know, is that real strong abstraction or abstract painting part of any painting that makes that interesting and actually holds us to stay in the painting and lead us around, if you will. I think that's part of both plein air and still life, and I guess I'm asking, do you feel the same way?
To the tens, Linda, to the tens. First of all, congratulations to the artist that just wrote in about doing thumbnails. You're absolutely right, and that's brilliant. And someday you might want to just go out, instead of doing a thumbnail, leave your paint gear at home and go out and just draw and see how that happens. But doing the thumbnail, congratulations to you and bravo. That's a really brilliant thing. There is no good painting that does not have a strong abstract quality. If it doesn't have a strong abstraction, it's never going to be a strong representational painting. I mean, I don't know the single painting I've ever seen that I thought, well, you know, it's beautifully rendered, but it's, you know, if it didn't have an abstract quality, I just don't see the art there. And I think almost everybody will tell you that. So if you put down a piece of information, the result might be that it's an orange or a tree or a pear or a building, but the intent from the beginning should be, it's that piece of information where it belongs in this picture plane.
Mm-hmm. Joe, one of the things I wanted to talk about as well, and you kind of touched on it, is that still life painting is composed, and you know we have to create the environment, and then plein air painting is basically before you, and you're still doing some creation in that process. But does that make still life artists more creative?
That's a great question, and you and I have had that discussion before. I really don't think so, because that's what we're saying there is just because you go out and set your easel up in front of a mountain, the work is done. Well, it isn't. The work has just begun, because you still have to move. Literally, don't you love it that as artists we move mountains? I love that. So you're still moving. You're still composing your heart out. And in fact, you outside, you may get to the painting and you may realize that you need to change an important piece of information. So it's very, very creative. As you take authority from the scene and put it inside you. So that's very creative. Still life, I think, the fact that you start with nothing, here's some good news and some bad news. The good news is you start with nothing. It is very creative, what you decide to paint and how you decide to paint it. And I think that is the good news and does make it a very creative process. I think there's some bad news in that the whole genre tends to be a little bit negated because there's so much bad still. I know there's a lot of bad landscape, but there's so much bad still life out there. And I think it's because we give up, and I know I'm repeating here, but we give up too soon about creating a composition that really works hard. I mean, people will come to a workshop, and Linda, I think you saw a little bit of this, and they'll work 15 minutes on a setup and then wonder why the painting was just so-so. You know, well, when you've worked days, weeks, months, and I'm not saying that, you know, that every painting that I do that happens. You know, the good news is cumulative time does have an effect. You know, I've taught design compositions in different ways, so that does help. But I think it can be, still life can be done in such a lackadaisical manner, and we're satisfied with our composition too soon. So the good news is, yes, I think it's incredibly creative because you do start with nothing. The bad news is, I don't think we work hard enough on our compositions in still life paintings, and I would like to see more thinking about that. And one of the things that I've started to do about that, and I pulled this on the guys. I taught a 5-day workshop in Texas last week. Is I set up some very difficult environments, huge environments where there were compositions within. Basically, mm-hmm. thinking of it as if it were a landscape. You go out and you have 300 around you in a landscape. You're 360 degrees. Oh my goodness, what do you do? Well, you don't. You select from that environment outdoors what is going to touch you, what's going to make a good painting, what things you have to change, what things you are stay the same. So I basically did this in a still life composition. I rarely set things up and then have anybody paint them because that's doing the work for you and I don't believe in that. But I actually set up very complex things and the artist then had to go and find their compositions within these complex environments, just as you have to go outdoors and find your composition from what's there. So guys, you might try that. Go to a farmer's market or a flower shop and something and see if you can find within the complexities a composition inside those, just as you do out of doors. And that's a pretty exciting way to begin your thinking of composition of still life. You're really not thinking about still life versus plein air or still life objects or figures versus landscape. It's all the same. You are composing, you're making a canvas. You're making a composition from whatever's there. So I don't think we can say that one's better than the other. Just because you start with nothing in a still life, I don't think that's better or worse. You still have to compose, and you still have to hang in there until the composition works.
Okay. Joanna, I have a question about the composition. I think it's really exciting when I'm out painting and that shift happens in my brain, the way I'm seeing, where whatever it is I'm painting, it really does become that whole exciting motif of relationships of shapes and values and simplifying value shapes and fitting things in. And, that's such an exciting place to paint from, where you're no longer just stuck in the ordinary world and seeing things in their symbolic way like we do if we're not really paying attention. But when you're setting up that composition or when you're painting and you want to make a correction, are there some kinds of guidelines? Are there certain things you look for that say, oh, this is way off? What could I do to correct this? Can you give us some guidance on composition itself?
Wow. Composition, I think, is one of the hardest things to teach because composition is so personal. That if I taught you composition from my point of view, I would be teaching you my composition, and that's a wrong thing to do, you know, because we all have a slightly different or sometimes drastically different sense of composition, what works for us. I mean, if there were one set of compositional rules, there would be a museum with five or six paintings, and that's all there would be. So obviously there's no one thing that you can do. But there are some things that are important. I mean, you guys know that when you go outside, you want to have, you know, a nice viewfinder. You want to have it marked off either thirds. I find thirds easier than the golden section because there you have to start with a certain proportion of canvas, and there rarely do we go out with that. But why do it? It's very, very close to thirds. And
right.
So you want to look at where the thirds cross and see if there's something important. And this is with the still life as well, where those lines of thirds cross. There might be something there that's a little bit more important than some other spot. And it doesn't necessarily have to be one thing, because you don't want the eye to go to that one sweet spot and stay there. You know, the eye still has to move, but you hope that it travels back to that place that's important. So let me give you an example. Let's talk about yellow for a minute, because a lot of you guys that paint landscape know that yellow is an incredibly important and aggressive color. And so putting yellow in a painting, you want to make sure that yellow is something important to you. And if you don't want it important, if you don't want the eye to go to yellow, you better leave it out. So let's say you put the lemon on the third. That might be the same place that you would put the windmill or something else that would be important. You want to, looking at your viewfinder, you want to stay away from center. You don't want to divide the canvas. I was just teaching on the coast and that's the only place you actually can see a horizon line. You want to make sure that your horizon line is anywhere but middle. But, you know, those are real easy beginner things, guys. And so taking the time, I'll tell you one thing that will help is that if you'll do your drawing indoors or outdoors and you draw something that you think is kind of interesting, that has an interesting path, draw it smaller on a piece of paper and then crop it several different times, several different ways. Crop it as a vertical, crop it as a horizontal, crop it with even still life. This is a longer discussion, but still every painting has a horizon line. Even still lifes do. You don't see them most of the time in landscape paintings. But move your horizon high, move it low. You can do that by recropping the drawing that you're working on. Those are some really, really big things. I don't really think there's anything of major difference between landscape composition and indoor composition. I mean, you guys are accustomed to editing and modifying and outdoors. We think this is a great big difference. There really isn't. Good composition is good composition. Your eye wants to go to a certain place that's a bit more important. Your eye wants, in a good composition, your eye wants a place to rest. You don't want to have so much going on that your viewer is attacked by every square inch of the canvas. You've got to give them resting places. You've got to give them, think about it like this. They've never met you before, but they're coming to your party. That's your painting. So meet them at the door. Take them by the hand and bring them through your painting. Bring them on that interesting journey through your painting. And then pay it off someplace and say, okay, here's the birthday cake. Pay it off someplace important. I mean, that might sound like a silly thing, but it's a pretty easy thing to remember that every painting should have a very good payoff, but every painting should have some way to travel through. Another important thing to remember is that still life, as in landscape, should have different scales of things. Some things large, some things small. The eye should be able to travel over different scales of things, just as you wouldn't go outside and make all the trees exactly the same size. So you wouldn't make everything in a still life the same scale either. Another thing to remember is that the eye enjoys great variety in shapes. So if you have a lot of round shapes, you want some angular shapes. But I think if there is an umbrella to that, it would just be give your viewer a variety of shapes and angles and things to look at. Take them by the hand. Lead them through your composition. Make sure that there's one place that's more celebrated than others. Make sure that you have places that their eye can rest, and keep the movement going. I hope that helps a little bit. Composition is so personal.
Oh, I love that answer. I think that's absolutely fantastic. Thank you.
I have a question, Joanne, it's about, we touched on it a little bit earlier. I was going to set up a still life outdoors, if you do that, is that considered plein air, or is it still life? Where does it fit in? Could it be entered into a plein air competition?
Absolutely, because plein air means in the open air. It doesn't mean painting landscapes in the open air. And there are wonderful examples of the greats that, you know, Sargent, for one. I just did a version of one of his outdoors, which is, you know, had this rickety, wonderful chair, and I cut some of the flowers from my garden and put them in a watering can and painted the chair out of doors. Sargent has a great painting that is so simple. It's called The Old Chair, and it's a chair with a tiny vase of a couple of, they're either lilies or roses. The critics say they're lilies, and I say they're roses, and you don't care. You really can't tell. But that's definitely an outdoor piece. So I think the point about outdoors, we think about what is it painting in the plein air. You're outside. The light is moving. The light is changing. You had to lock in your value scheme early on, just as you have to do with a landscape or figure outside. So I think plein air is anything that you're painting outside in the open air with that wonderful, uncontrollable, changing light situation. And I totally believe we include figures in that conversation too. If it's painted outside in plein air, the subject doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. I was curious about that. It's sort of murky in there.
Well, you might every now and then have someone, a judge of a show that said, you know, if it's not a landscape, it's not in plein air. But that's just not true. There's so much precedent in art history that denies that. I mean, there are lots and lots of examples of. Let's go to one of my favorite artists. There's a fabulous artist whose name was Sergei Bungart, and he was very much of a colorist, a California artist, Russian school. And he almost only taught the outdoor still life, you know, and a fabulous artist, because he pretty much anything he tackled he did very well. But that's one that you can look at. He would do things like a colorful blanket on a fence, hanging on a fence, and have his students out there painting the dappled light on that. And that, you know, the blanket didn't move, but the light did. If the light moves, guys, it's plein air.
That's a good definition.
Very, very helpful. Jen, Barbara, I'm going to steal one of your questions because I think it actually will fit in really well here. There's the term impressionist or impressionism. And plein air. Is there a difference between those two?
To me, there is. There's a great difference. To me, impressionism. Well, you know, that's interesting. We go back and we look up impressionism, and we are using it in modern terms that are quite different from the art historical use of it. I don't think the original. Artists that showed in the Salon Refuge would give the definition that we use now. We tend to say impressionism is the same thing as loose brush. I mean, I think you could substitute those two words. So you could say, oh, what kind of painter are you? Well, I'm a loose brush painter. Well, we use the word impressionism. But you think back to that first Salon, that was not what it meant. It meant that they were doing impressions of things, and you think about the style of the people that showed. Now, there were looser brushes in giving an impression of something, for sure, but not all the artists did total loose brush painting the way that we think about it today. So I think we have to first off start by saying that there's the historical understanding of the word impressionism, and then there's the way that I think we are using it today, which is, you know, the very looser brush. So it tends to be, most people think of that word as synonymous with a very loose brush technique. So if you think about that and plein air, there are artists who are fantastic plein air artists who do not paint with a loose brush. They paint with a much tighter brush. I've got a few, but I won't name them because some of them I don't like and some of them I do.
I do like a Luther brush, and so some of the tighter artists that I'm not crazy about, I don't want to name their names, but they're terrific artists, mm-hmm. and they're wonderful, and they work outside in the plein air, but they paint with a tighter brush, and we cannot say, because they don't handle a brush the same way, that they are not plein air artists. So I think there is a good argument to be said that Impressionism and plein air are not the same thing. I think Impressionism tends to be a word that relates more to a stylistic thing, and plein air is just outside painting it in whatever style that you want.
Ah, okay. Thank you.
Joanna, do you use the same palette when you're painting outdoors that compared to what you use in the studio?
I do. I use a limited palette of about 10 colors plus white, and the only time it will change is if I'm going to a certain place. I may add a color that I think may be something that I need in a certain environment. I tend to add phthalo green, you know, which is a horrible dye color, which I adore. I definitely will take that to the seashore. I mix a lot of my blues and my colors and my water with that. I may not use that very much indoors. It's such a dye color, and it can get into so many mixtures. I used to take a few grays outside. I stopped doing that because I'm so enjoying mixing all of my grays from the primaries these days, and more than I've ever done before. But really, it's about the same 10 colors. It may vary one color here or there, but not much. And the reason, I really recommend a limited palette is because, you know, if you go out and buy tube colors, then you've got to learn how to use them. So much exciting color should be, in my opinion, is undermixed colors. And so if you're using a limited palette, you tend to undermix colors, and that leaves a lot of the parent colors being, you know, whatever you were using to make that color. It leaves some of the parent colors visible, and this is, again, let's go back to our party. You know, you want to invite somebody to your party and you want them entertained. Well, a person's eye is entertained by having to mix some of the colors, even on a very subtle level. If they're mixing some colors, it's a far more exciting journey for that person looking at your painting. So a limited palette encourages you to undermix colors, and it really, really, really encourages you to learn everything that those few colors will do and really explore that palette. And then you'll find very quickly that you just don't need a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, that I've always found that with less colors, you get a lot of experience mixing all those colors. You have to create them yourself. And outside, you don't need to carry that much either.
Yeah. There's that. Sure.
Don't break your back with the whole 40 tubes of paint that we carry out or whatever.
Huh?
But, Joe, I've got a question for you. You know that I paint a lot indoors, just mainly because of my work schedule that I have, and I can get downstairs to my studio more than I can outside. And we've talked about this concern that I've had before that does, you know, the things that I'm doing when I'm painting still life in my studio, will they carry over into the plein air work outside? How and what exactly can I take from my still life painting indoors to the outdoor with me? It becomes, I assume, you're more intuitive.
Yeah, you know, Linda, you can take a lot because. So the bad news and the good news about painting indoors is the good news is you have more time to study out your forms. The bad news is you have more time to study out your forms. And that's why I think so much indoors, it can look very labored and very overdone. So I think we need to remember to keep that kind of energy. There's an energy when we're painting out of doors. And if we'll try to bring that same energy indoors and give yourself some of the same time limitations as you have out of doors so that you don't labor and labor and labor something and literally paint the life out of it. And, but having said that, what you can indoors, you can really, really learn to model form. You can learn to study form. You can take some more time in learning how to mix colors, because outdoors we have to make very quick decisions. So if you've taken your time, if you've learned, you've taken a whole day
to mix your grays indoors and learn what your palette will do, learn what that limited, however many colors you use, learn your palette, then out of doors, then you mix much more quickly because you have much more confidence. So also drawing, if you'll take some time indoors to draw, everything that you draw makes a difference. And I don't care what it is. It doesn't matter if it's you know, an orange or the earth. It's the same form. So every drawing that you do makes your drawing better. So inside, you've got a little bit more time to study out a drawing, to really understand a drawing. You've got more time to study form, to understand form. You've got more time to truly understand your palette, to truly learn the mixtures that will work, so that you'll be making quicker decisions outside because you've done that decision-making process indoors, and you've really learned your palette and how to mix very quickly. Another thing, and Linda, we talked about this last week, if you learn how to model, in other words, to make three-dimensional your basic universal forms, then let's take a rectangle. You know, the sun is from one direction or the other, and you learn indoors from a fixed light, from a non-moving light. You learn how to model that rectangle. I'm just pulling that out because I happen to be looking at one. So you learn with a fixed light situation how to model a certain form, a rectangle, a house, a whatever. And then outdoors, as your light changes, and it will, we all know that, then you're no longer a victim. You've got complete control because you know how to model a rectangle, a cylinder, a sphere. You know how to model those things from doing it inside. You've done it and done it and done it. So when a bus pulls in front of your scene, you're fine. Or the light changes, you're still fine. You're not a victim of having to run with the light or chase the light, as we say. So there's a great deal to be learned. You can master certain forms, certain colors indoors, and a great deal of confidence. Take all that outside and react with more spontaneity and more confidence.
Right. You'd be proud of me, Joanna. I'm doodling doodling spheres and cylinders and cones so, while I'm talking to you. So.
Yay. Well, the command you have over all of those things, it just should be automatic. Being able to model the form of what you're saying, that should be something that's just a no-brainer for you. You should be able to model spheres standing in the line of the grocery store. You know, it's just something you should make part of the repertoire. So when you have a command, spheres that constitute a tree or a water, whatever, you can command it, and you're no longer a victim of things happening, life change, trips bothering you, buses pulling up.
Okay. We've got probably a little over 6 minutes left, so I'm going to go around and ask Blanche first. Is there anything else you'd like to ask Joanna?
Well, something I was just thinking of while we're having that discussion, with all the advantages of still life painting and plein air painting, it seems like we need to do it all. There's something to learn from everything. People seem to label themselves as being called a plein air artist or a still life artist, and that seems so limited. We should just be artists. Maybe that has more to do with marketing than art when someone calls themselves one thing or another. Just a thought I was having as we were discussing that.
It's a really good point, and I think it's definitely something that everybody associated with AMMO should think about, because, you know, you guys are you're professionals or you're about to be professionals. You guys are really doing great work and studying hard. I've looked at the challenges that you guys are submitting work, and it's very exciting. It's great fun to watch. You make a great point. The fact that an artist is labeled a certain thing or another, I think, is far more a marketing question than anything else. It's certainly, I don't think it has anything to do with an artist's capability. You know, I think it's probably easier from a marketing point of view to be one thing or another. It's easier to write about you. It's easier for the magazines to grasp on and write copy about you. But I don't think we should do that. I think you should paint what you want to paint, where you don't want to paint. I mean, there are times we can't go outside.
There are times that we, you know, we want to develop something in the studio. There are times that we, I want to paint something in the studio. So I don't like the labels. And I think you're right. I think your point about it's more of a marketing issue. So if you want the editors to have an easier time writing about you, do one thing or the other. If you want to have a fulfilled life as an artist, paint what you want to paint.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, that's a great point.
Well, and if you look back at most of I don't want to be all-inclusive, but a lot of artists, master artists, have painted portraits. They've painted landscapes. They've painted still lives. They tried their hand at abstraction, you know, abstract painting at some point in time. You know, there's always this growth that needs to happen, and they certainly haven't cornered themselves in labeling themselves one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
So,
question. There in art history, especially recent, but not necessarily the. Well, I was going to say that's not true, but I'm thinking about some of my favorite artists from art history, and if we want to talk about still life, let's start in France in the 17th century. Chardin is almost every still life painter is hero starting off. I mean, before that, of course, they're the Dutch masters, and that's a whole other discussion. That's hours of discussion. But Chardin was as well known for his what call them genre scenes of domestic preparation of food in the kitchen and portraits as well. So Chardin is a great example. I think if we want to go contemporary, just look at the as they call him, Schmidt Almighty, the wonderful Richard Schmidt, portrait, still life, and landscape, all drawing as well. He did it all, and happily so. Sargent is, you know, we all love Sargent, and why not? And he loved, I mean, he of course, the portrait and the people are what he's most known for, but you read about his life, and he had to take breaks and loved doing landscape and going out with his friends and painting and painting outside and found great relief in that and really yearned for it. So there throughout art history there can be cited wonderful artists who did portrait, figures, still life, and landscape. And the other thing about that discussion, guys, is I think you should, if you're early on in your development, you should at least try them all, because you don't really know where your heart lives until you try them.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's a great point. You don't want to limit yourself.
Absolutely.
No, you really shouldn't. You really shouldn't. I mean, and you know, I've had a number of landscape classes, and people who have taken my still life classes, and they'll go outside and they'll say, well, this is great, Joanna. When do we get to go inside? Because the bugs are bothering me, and I ran out of sunscreen. And I'm thinking, okay, you know, they're a studio painter, and I'm not going to change that. But it's happened the other way around. Landscape painters will come indoors and find that they love working in a controlled light situation. So who are we, guys, to say, you know, I'm going to label you this, I'm going to label you that. I mean, it's a really bad thing to do, because there's an artist that's already inside of you, and that artist exists. And what you're trying to find is both subject matter and stylistically, what are those things that thrill you? And it should be something that you just passionately want to get up every morning and do. And it may be indoors, it may be outdoors. It may be taking some of your outdoor work and bringing it indoors for a fuller, more adult, more understanding of development. But I think if we draw lines around ourselves, that we're in danger of limiting and maybe not discovering that masterpiece that's inside of you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Oh, that's a wonderful point.
Mm-hmm. Barbara,
I think
you have one last question.
Well, yes, I do. In responding to that, I'm very moved by your answer, Joanna, and I think that it's so easy for all of us as artists and as individuals to, you know, grow up almost seeking permission, and that it seems to be a real rite of passage when you get to a certain point where you want to paint what you are passionate about, and you actually seek your own permission rather than maybe what would sell best or what this gallery might prefer or that kind of thing. And, you know, your answer, like, well, if you label yourself, it might be good for marketing. you know, there was a question we also had for you about collectors. Do you think that you have a completely different group of collectors for, like, some people who really just are passionate about your landscapes versus your still lives? Is that true for you? Do you have a different group of collectors?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a great question, and my development has been, I've been at this a long time, and my first influence was very definitely toward the Dutch still life, and having trained at the Art Students League, and it was, you know, very somber and very umber, and the piece that I wrote, which was in 1997, was much more influenced by Dutch painting than my influences today. And when I left that and began to paint in a more fluid manner and a little bit bolder with less detail and somewhat of a diversion from the things I've been painting, I did lose collectors. And I have collectors today who want me to go back to that because that's the painting that they own. So I did lose that market, and it was a choice, and it was a financial choice as well. And it hurt early on because I was labeled a certain thing. So it took a while for collectors to begin to understand that I was very serious about outdoor, and then after they realized that, you know, artists grow just like everybody else and we all change, then it took them a while. I have a strong collector base, but after a while they began. Let me say it was years. It was several years. They began to realize that the validity was there in the outdoor work, and they began to collect. But there was a gap. There was a big gap, and I still today have a few of my collectors who only want still life, but most of my current collectors own both types of paintings. And I'm hoping, because I've got a series of figurative pieces from the markets in Ecuador, which is so exciting. So I'm hoping when I introduce that later on in the year that they're going to be, what is the woman doing now? I'm going to hear that, and then they're going to have to catch up. You know, they'll either go with me or they'll be a new collector. But pretty much present day, it's my collectors, most of my collectors own both still life and landscape.
Well, you're definitely not seeing yourself.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that last question.
Oh, I said that's great. You're not limiting yourself like what we talked about earlier. You're following your passion. You're not limiting yourself to one thing or the other.
You know, guys, if all four of us would say, I think one thing to the people that are kind enough to listen, that the most important advice that we could give to any artist in any stage of development is to follow your heart, find your passion, and paint that. You know, if as long as you're doing that, the subject doesn't matter at all.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very true. I don't think I ever would have painted hats, Joanna.
Okay, well, to explain that, I set up an entire hat shop in my last still life, but it was sort of an homage to the Degas millinery shop. He did three or four paintings of a shop girl and wonderful hats, and I thought they were great forms. And so this last workshop, I set up an entire hat shop, and I made them find their composition inside the hat shop. And I have to say, they surprised me. They thrilled me. They made me laugh. The artists did better than I had any idea. So, yeah, I mean, I didn't know if anybody would be passionate about hats or not, but as it turned out, they were.
Yeah, but thank God you brought the Degas book, because that got me very interested, because he's one of my favorite artists. So I was like, well, if he can do it, I can give this a try.
Well, it was a great painting, Linda. I was thrilled with it.
Yeah, I am too. I'm actually anxiously awaiting for it to appear on my doorstep since we shipped it back. So I hope it doesn't disappear in the process. Joanna, you had mentioned Ecuador in your last comments. I want to give you some time to talk about what you've got coming up. You've got wonderful workshop opportunities and also your one-woman show.
Well, thank you, Linda. This I think my life as a teacher has been, you know, it's not what I do for a living, guys. I teach about 10% of my income is teaching, but it's gotten me some wonderful places in the world, and it's let me meet you guys and some wonderful people that are real treasures in my life, and I've loved that part of my life as a teacher. But I was hired last year to go to Ecuador by PASA, Plein Air South America. And I wasn't really sure, you know, what do you paint in Ecuador? And I woke up the first morning, opened the curtains of my picture window, and right outside was a volcano that was absolutely brilliant green and roses growing almost all the way up to it. So I was just floored about the landscape opportunities there. So it's very unspoiled. It's not painted. And so most people don't know that it's tremendous. Where we are. It's 9,000 feet, and it's just mountains and haciendas, and everybody puts their laundry out. And if you can imagine, it's like going back a couple of hundred years and painting before electricity. And it's a very, very innocent and very, very beautiful place. I'm excited about that. And then the market scenes that I'm working on now, which we went one day, several days, to go to the markets, which are very innocent. You know, there's very little refrigeration or electricity out in the pueblos, and so you know that the markets are chickens and pigs and llamas, and so we went one day, and we were drawing all these things and just spent the day drawing, and it was so much fun because they don't like people with cameras, but people with a sketchbook, we were rock stars. I mean, they would actually come up, look over our shoulders, and start voting on the drawings. It was one of the most fun days of my life, and I simply love that. And so I'm going to be going back and doing all of that again this coming. It'll be in late August, which is Ecuador has no seasons. It's as high as we are. It's always spring, so flowers always bloom. There's always hydrangeas. There's always roses. Calla lilies, they beat back off the road. It's just an amazing place for the vegetation. So that's very exciting. It's like some of the most amazing greens I've ever seen. So we'll go springtime in August down to we'll start off in Quito. So that'll be a wonderful 10-day workshop with a day at the commercial rose farm. And because 60% of the cut roses in the world's florists come from Ecuador. I didn't know that, but we went to these rose farms and painting these amazing specimen roses. So it's all the way from painting mountains and volcanoes to haciendas. The hacienda where we stay is a working dairy and horse farm, and there is even a day that we actually rode horses to a location, and they took our gear in the Range Rover, so that was really a lot of fun. So that's my most fun plein air experience coming up. I have some still life workshops coming up, and I'm really looking forward to those. And so basically I do 50-50. I do half outdoors and about half indoors, and I love them both. The show that I'm going to be doing in the early part of 2013, which I'm painting now, is going to be about what we were talking about before, being labeled. And I'm going to do a show that's about an evolution from an indoor painter to outdoors and to the figurative things that I'm working on. So there will be everything in that show, and it will be about that evolution from indoors to out and back again.
Oh, cool. I'm actually hoping that I can get out to your opening, so I'm keeping my fingers crossed that I can make it out there when it is. So keep
I hope you will.
With
I hope
that.
You will.
What is the opening date? I was wondering what the opening date is for your show, Joanna.
It's going to be in February here in Santa Fe at the Zappa Lambert Gallery, and it's going to coincide with an event that we have that's the town has a really fun thing that they do. It's called Art Feast, and it's where the galleries partner with particular restaurants. And so my gallery, Zapp and Lampert, will be partnering with the Italian restaurant Osteria, which is owned by some wonderful gentlemen from Lake Como, and I will actually have Lake Como paintings in my show from having traveled and painted there. And they haven't set the date for Art Feast, so we're going to wait and see. It's February of 2013, and so we're going to make it the opening night so that you can come in, look at art, eat, and drink all at the same time. Three of my favorite things in the world.
So since I live nearby in Albuquerque, I'll be sure to be there.
Yeah. Great. I'll look forward.
Okay. And I want to remind everyone that if you want to check up on Joanna's workshops and her latest paintings and things like that, you can please go out and visit her website at www.joannaarnett.com. So, Joanna, thank you so much. I know we kept you longer than 60 minutes. I knew there was a reason why I scheduled 90 for this show. But thank you for all your wonderful information. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, it was a pleasure talking with you, and best wishes to everybody. Blanche and Barbara, you guys were great. What a joy. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about some things that really mean a lot to me. I'm really grateful.
Well, we're very grateful that you came, and naturally we'll probably call on you again in the future to talk with us, and hopefully you'll come back and join us.
My pleasure.
Okay. Want to mention our next show will be on May 17th. Our guest will be Allison Malafrante. We'll be talking about, is there a glass ceiling for women artists out there today? We actually titled the show, We've Come a Long Way, Baby, so you probably remember that saying from back when the, I guess if you want to call it the women's movement, feminist movement, whatever, started out. But Allison actually has a lot of wonderful things to say. We've actually started talking about that show, Allison and I have, and what it is we would like to talk about in that program. So we hope that you will join us. That's May 17th at 7 p.m. Eastern. And Blanche and Barbara, thank you so much for joining us as well, and always a pleasure to co-host with you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Joanna. I really enjoyed it, and thank you, Linda and Barbara.
Thank you all. This was very inspiring to me, and really, really enjoyed it. Thank you so much, Joanna.
Guys, it was my pleasure, and I will look forward to our next conversation.
Okay, and one more thing, too, is I know that we've had a number of live listeners that have been listening to us and some nice conversations that were going on in the chat room. So thank you all so much for tuning in, and we definitely will catch you next time. We're going to end with some music from my friend Wayne. Thanks, everyone. Have a good evening, and we'll catch you on May 17th.